Blog Talk Radio.
There must be lights burning brighter somewhere. Got to be birds flying higher in a sky more blue. If I can dream of a better land where all my brothers walk hand in hand, tell me why, oh why, oh why can my dream come true? Oh why? There must be peace and understanding sometime. Strong winds of promise that will blow away all the doubt and fear. If I can dream of a warmer sun where hope keeps shining, oh, heaven be one. Tell me why, oh, why, oh, why won't that sun appear?
Good evening. Hi, it's Marcia Cook. And it's a good story is a good story, and we have a great show today. We have a co-host, Jack Remick. Hi, Jack. How are you?
Hello, Marcia. How are you doing?
I'm fine, and I bet you've been on a lot of times, and so you're my co-host tonight. We're going to have a great show with Marianne Bruni, but we're going to talk about a few little things first so we get that out of the way so we don't have to do that, right? If for those of you that have not seen have not listened to yesterday's show, we had a really good show. Alejandro Monteverdi was on, and he's got a movie coming out, Little Boy. And Virginia and I were lucky enough to have the director, which is Alejandro, and he was on yesterday, and we were talking about his movie, and there's a 7-year-old little boy in it, and he's wonderful, and possibly for an Academy Award, this could be, because he's really great. And so we were talking how hard it was to get, you know, PR and publicity out there about the movie, because it's a small movie, and I think he didn't realize till Virginia and I were talking, that's what we do. We try to help everybody out there to get, because we know how hard this is. It's hard for the director, producer, it's hard for the writer, but in his eyes, he thinks everybody should work together, and they did, and they came out with a beautiful movie. It'll be out April 24th, and so we'll be hearing more from him, hopefully, and it's a really good movie, and it's going to be a word-of-mouth movie, so that's why we promised that we will talk about it, and it was a great show, so listen to him if you possibly can. It's on Archives of the World of Ink Network, and for all the screenwriters out there, it took him 3 years to write it. It didn't happen in one day. And we're going to be talking to Marianne Bruni, and it took her a while to do this, and she got it done, and that's why everything doesn't happen in 1 minute. But first we're going to talk about Jack. Jack, how are you?
I'm doing real well, you know.
I think everybody does, you know, you should talk a little bit about yourself, because I'm always talking about you on my shows, Jack Remick, Jack Remick, Jack Remick. So let's hear what Jack Remick does.
Okay, well, let's see, I'm a writer. I've written now 16 books. I've got a new one coming out in July, which is the final book in the California Quartet. It's called Trio of Lost Souls. I just had a poetry book come out called Satori. That was in May. Well, it was May of last year. Good grief, it's been that long. I do workshops now and then. In fact, that's how I met Marianne, was a workshop in New Mexico with Natalie Goldberg. And that was quite an experience, as Marianne will tell you. I'm a poet. That's about it. You know, I write
You forgot to add one thing. You understand women more than I've ever seen anybody understand women. Okay, we have to add that because it's true. It is true. You really like strong women, and you know, you've told, you know, I've met a lot of people that you've introduced me to that are strong women, which we definitely have one on today. So, you know, Mary, she does.
Well, let me just piggyback on that, Marcia. You know, my book, Gabriella and the Widow, which was a finalist in, you know, some of those competitions, That was pretty much the hardest book that I have ever written, and yet it just flowed out. It just came very easy because I was really doing something that I had never done before at that depth. And so the book has a certain appeal, and people have talked to me, and when I do those interviews and they say, we thought this had to have been written by a woman, you know, and I said, no, all you have to do is get inside a woman's skin and you can do this. You know? So that's
just isn't always that easy, Jack. It's not that easy.
That's right. Yeah. So, okay, that's where I am.
Okay. Marianne, she's a photographer, a journalist, an author, a pilot, an activist, and I mean, director, producer of this new documentary, Quest for Honor. Marianne, we're so happy to have you on, and I got a chance. I'm so glad today you called for a few minutes, thinking it was Jack, it was me, so it was great I got to talk to you. And I think this is a different show than we've ever done before, but Jack knows that I love to do shows about different subjects, and you've done unbelievable work. So, hi, Marianne, how are you?
Well, I'm fine, and I'm very happy to be here. I adore Jack. We've had so much fun working together, and I really enjoyed my conversation with you today, Marcia.
Oh, good. Thank you. Thank you. And, you know, I'll tell you, you know, when I watch the videos, I mean, you know, I think that it's a busy world, and we really forget what's happening outside of our own lives. So why don't you give us a little, you know, info about really what's going on there and why you did this?
Well, I guess I'm a little obsessed by the Kurds. I've spent time in the Middle East. I spent a lot of time in Turkey and enjoyed that. And then was asked by Erdal İnönü, the opposition leader, to go on a trip to the southeast, which meant the Kurdish part of Turkey. And from there, I ended up following, covering that, the Gulf War, from the first Gulf War from there. And later, when the Kurds, the Iraqi Kurds, uprising failed, I went up in the mountains with them and then followed them on in to the territory they had won back and stayed there for a couple of years. So
just stayed there for a couple of years.
Years,
you
know.
So easily, you know. Well, what was that like? What was that experience like, Marianne? I mean, staying there for a couple of years. You've done things that Americans just, well, we don't even know what that part of the world is. And you spent so much time there that it must be sort of eye-opening for us to hear you talk about that. How did you live? What did you do?
Well, I was representing the United States at a drama festival gathering in Istanbul, and when I got through, I just went down to the border, rented a car, and drove. The border was completely open, of course, because Saddam had deserted that part of Iraq, and just drove across and kept going, trying to find the people I'd met in the camps during the failure of the uprising, and I found this one place, and I thought, this is where I want to be. It was a beautiful waterfall, just the most beautiful place I've ever seen, and the mountains, et cetera, all of the Kurdish type of things. And I told the person who'd driven me, I said, he said, we've got to go back to Turkey because now it's time, you know, it's time to get back there. You need to get a hotel, et cetera. I said, no, I'm going to stay here. And I pointed to this hotel. I said, let's stay over there. He said, we can't. That's a Peshmerga camp. Well, I said, well, let's ask. So we asked, and they said, no, this is a Peshmerga camp. There are no women here. And I saw this woman walking by the side of the road. I said, that's a woman. Ask her if I can stay with her. No, that's our commander's wife. We can't talk to her. Anyway, someone finally did ask her, and the next thing I knew, three Peshmerga came, took my bags, and moved me into the hotel where I stayed for about 4 months.
4 months.
Well, this whole question of women in that part of the world, how did you have to conceal yourself? Did you have to do things that you wouldn't have done here in the States? You know, how do you coexist in a society that really sees women as kind of second class?
Well, I wouldn't go that far as to say
okay.
the Kurds consider women as second class. They may try to sometimes, but Kurdish women are surprising, and I don't think they let the men get by with that. I quite enjoyed this hotel had been commandeered by Ali Shaban Aga, and his wife Layla was the one who invited me, and I moved into sort of the family part of the hotel. The rest of the hotel was like 125 Peshmerga, but we were in the family part, and I was with the women, with Layla and her daughters. So it was quite wonderful. It was reminded me of my childhood, in that we were all so close, the women and I were so close and had such fun together. And also it reminded me of when I lived on the border in the Texas border with Mexico. The women gathered together there too. But while Layla kept a strict harem because she was an aristocratic woman, and that was the way they did in the Badanan, she really was quite free. And what I liked, Jack, and I would have never thought that would happen in the Middle East, is we were waited on by these lovely young men in Kurdish dress, you know, who had like silver platters full of food and things, and took care of us, drove us places, completely cared for us.
So that was the way they trained
the young Peshmerga, was to serve the women.
Okay, so you think that Kurdistan has a slightly different view of women than other places in the Middle East?
Well, look at Turkey. Turkish women are certainly very active, and I think that sometimes we get the wrong idea of women in the Middle East.
There are places they cover. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But are the young ones that are coming up, the daughters, are they scared at all? I mean, because when they, you know, when they do things that don't honor their family, this is when they could get into problems. Is that, can we assume
that's true? Now, that was my first,
our
first film, Quest for Honor, dealt with Kurdish women fighting the idea of honor killing. And of course, it did show, in fact, it showed one woman being killed, and then it certainly gave you the idea that women could be killed there. But a lot of those things are, they're not Muslim, first of all. They're really tribal, and it's the idea of women as property. And I think that that's disappearing as women take on more and more jobs in the Middle East. Now, I don't know about Saudi Arabia and some places, but I found that Iranian women, Turkish women, and Iraqi women very independent. And in Jordan, certainly so.
Well,
and very few cover.
That's a very different view than what we get.
Yeah.
You know, we get, of course, the extremist view of women. I guess you'd call it the media view, you know, and so forth. But you open all kinds of windows when you open up a different view like that.
One
of the things I noticed is I actually, for several reasons, was given a month's passage, a month's visa in Iran back in 2003, and absolutely was amazed. I got on an airplane in Istanbul dressed something like a penguin, and the women around me were legally covered in that they were wearing loose short coats, but they looked quite fashionable and very sexy in some cases. I looked like a complete idiot, and found out that, you know, not many women really dress like that in Tehran. And I found the women there really fantastic, and they were always talking to me and taking me places and doing things. So a few years later, when there was an uprising in Iran, and for the first time people on TV saw women as I had seen them in blue jeans. So, of course, they have on some kind of covering, but it's light. It's not it's not so oppressive as you would think. And someone said, oh, they've changed so much. I said, they haven't changed at all. What you're seeing is them taking pictures of themselves with cell phones as opposed to some government expedition of some sort that they've asked the press to cover, that's where people are dressed very conservatively and really rather strangely and criticizing the United States. But
can I just ask you a question while you're saying, I wanted to, so I don't forget this. Now, you were dressed the way you were, and we see it so different. I think Jack's probably thinking that too, what we see on TV. So how do you feel, though, about the fact that when, you know, they're portraying it, we don't see that at all. We don't really see the freedom that you're saying that, you know, I guess what they're doing is they're taking selfies like all the kids are, you know, the young kids are doing, and everybody's taking of themselves, you know, mm-hmm. and they're doing it. So we don't see that. Jack, would you agree that we don't see that too much? I mean, I don't.
Well, I just want to piggyback on that question, too.
Yeah.
We read about the women being involved with the Peshmerga fighting ISIS or Daesh, you know. Have you mm-hmm. have you seen that up close and personal? And do you know for a fact that, you know, the women are on the front lines?
Yes. Well, there are different types of, I mean, Kurdistan's really divided into four parts. That's mainly in the Turkish part of Kurdistan, I think, the PKK. And, yes, the women, I've seen a lot of those women up in the mountains. They are, as I understand, quite ferocious fighters. Luckily, I've never fought with one, so I don't know. But but they're quite respected. And yes, they do fight.
Yeah,
they do.
Well, I guess see, you're giving us a really broader perspective than we would get through the media, and I really think that's important for us to know that that's not a monochromatic world, that it's not a single mindset, that in fact there's a lot of complexity there that we haven't been exposed to. Are you covering some of that in your next documentary, your next film?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just spoke at the Explorers Club, and one of the things I showed a short film. And what I talked about was that one of the main points I made is that Ibrahim Ahmet, who was a very famous intellectual and novelist, told me early on, I think back in 1991, he said, if you're going to try to portray the Kurds, don't talk to politicians and experts. Talk to villagers, because the intelligence of Kurdistan lies in the people. And I took that very seriously.
Wow.
And while I've known leaders and I've known politicians, I really spend time with normal people, from school teachers, to my friend Dr. Atiyah, who's a doctor, to another friend who's a mayor of a small town, to a variety, and to some of the widows that were left, the Barzani widows that were left after Saddam's attempt to genocide the Kurds. So I've known at a personal level any number of Middle Eastern women, and And to get off the Kurds for a minute, I got a big kick out of some of my friends in Turkey. They had a group they called the Poisons, and I said, well, what is that? It was short for the Poison Ivies. It was women who'd graduated from Ivy League schools.
Huh?
and they were anything but submissive. They were quite activist. So,
yeah, you know, it really is different hearing this. Yeah, hearing this is so different than what we see. And even on YouTube, when you look at some of the YouTubes that are about this, they don't portray it so nicely, you know, and it looks scary. So when I talked to you before, you're not scared at all to be there, I assume.
No, I'm not at all frightened. I'm quite comfortable. It reminds me a lot. Well, it reminds me very much of New Mexico. And it reminds me very much of South Texas. It has that same sort of laid-back Western sort of, and very close families. Everything's, as I was just reading a sociology study of the Kurds, and it was talking about how land and family were so important to them. Well, that's not very different than northern New Mexico or South Texas. That may not be true in New Jersey, but it is in our part of the world.
Well, that brings us to, you know, the sort of the flip side of this discussion. What is the Kurdish, or what is your perception of the Kurdish view of the West, and specifically of America? You say that women graduated from Ivy League schools, so they're obviously going to educate the women. The women are going to come back. What do they bring with them from their perspective? How do they see the America, U.S., this world?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, when I was talking about the Turks, the Ivy League graduates, I was talking about Turkish friends. I never could learn to speak Turkish, and one of the reasons I never could was that so many of my friends were educated in America, and in the West, and spoke English even among themselves very often.
Right.
So it made it very difficult for me to learn Turkish outside of learning, you know, how to tell a cab driver where I wanted to go or something like that. I never got much past that, and I was really kind of embarrassed by it. But I found the women in Iraqi Kurdistan very independent. One of the reasons is the mountain life and the fact that so many men were killed. I mean, Saddam, and this is something that's not talked about very much, Saddam had a very effective genocide going against the Kurds. I mean, they were, you know, counting off how many they could kill, and they were rewarding people for killing more than others. It was a very real thing, and it makes it hard at this point to ever really piece back together, if indeed Iraq ever existed as a country.
You mentioned in your notes in your presentation to the Explorers Club that Saddam was responsible for the total destruction of 4,500 Kurdish villages. Give us an idea how that translates into human bodies, human beings.
Yeah.
4,500, are there 1,000 people in a village, 500,000? What are we talking about?
I think there was a very good report made, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting exactly which human rights organization made it, on the Kurdish genocide, but about 180,000 people were killed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Do we
people
see
that are
50-50 men and women or children?
Yeah.
Children too, everybody, everyone. Now, in the case of the Barzanis, they decided they had this plan that if they killed all the men, the women wouldn't be able to survive. And as it turned out, the women raised their children, and the next generation, they were back again. And leading, have become leaders.
They're resilient. They're resilient.
Yes.
Now, the women that are having the Ivy League, you know, education, do they leave and come to America or go different places, or do they stay?
They stay. I think most people come back. Well, that's one thing I want to talk about, too, right now. One of the problems, and it's not talked about nearly enough in the press, is the problem with refugees right now. The number of refugees is horrifying. In just last month in Iraqi Kurdistan, there are almost 1 million refugees just in the Duhok government. And the Duhok government only has 1.2 million inhabitants. And a doctor there told me that doctors, in order to serve those refugees, are working 12-hour days, and that they're running low on medicines and on tools, et cetera. And basically, the refugees there aren't even particularly Kurds. There are a lot of Christians there. That area, the Kurdish area, has a large Christian population, and also the Christians coming from Baghdad are there, and numerous religions that are the old religions, the pre-Abrahamic religions, that are quite interesting and I think important to protect. We don't want to see them totally wiped out because they're a part of our history as much as anyone else's. But this is an international problem.
Just an aside on that, are the NGOs providing any of the medical aid for these refugees, or is it purely governmental, or how is any aid getting there at all?
I was shocked. I was expecting exactly what you're saying, Jack. I was expecting what I've seen other places. I was expecting to see various NGOs here, there, and yonder. Now, I did see a few, but generally speaking, the international community is not servicing these refugees, and it's not a sustainable situation. These people have just now the Kurds have taken a loan, but the doctor in charge told me when that loan runs out, it's going to be the end because no one's going to lend them any more money when they can't pay the loan.
Is there a lot of illness there then? I mean, if there's
there's not a lot of. I don't think there's a lot of illness. But if you have a million people that are living in camps, you have a lot of people to service. And just getting them water and basic food and basic needs. Now, I was this Sunday, even though I had something to do, I turned on Fareed Zakaria just for a few minutes, and the few minutes I listened to him, he said the same thing about Jordan. He was saying the Jordans, you know, they can't continue to service all of these refugees. But the problem, the uprisings and things there are causing such a refugee problem that if the international community doesn't jump in and help, I think it's going to cause some worldwide problems, and it's certainly going to help the evil sources that be over there.
Wow. Well, in your
that's unbelievable. Yeah, it's a lot of stuff that we don't really hear. We don't hear this a lot, I don't think, as much as, you know, because I guess you don't realize how many people are there that are refugees. I don't think they, you know, and what will they plan on doing with them, though, if there's so many of them?
Well, that's a good question. If there's no help, and in the past when these kind of things have happened, the international communities jumped in, but all of a sudden, I guess the international community is probably afraid of losing people in the wars or this. I don't know what the reason is, but it's very shocking. And in the Kurds case, as I said, you have these very old Christian religions, and you have these ancient religions that predecede all of the Abrahamic religions and Zoroastrianism and the places we know, and they will be wiped out if there's not help.
Can you characterize those religions for us? You know, how do they compare to Islam? How do they compare to, you know, American Christianity or European Christianity? What distinguishes those ancient religions from the current religions that we see in the world?
Yeah.
Well, for one thing, I want to say something about Islam. We have so flattened the idea of Islam. People talk about Islam and as something very simple to define, and it's sort of like saying Christianity and meaning everybody from Constantine to Adolf Hitler, you know. But one of the things is that in the Kurdish area, no one ever mentions this. We talk about the Shia and the Sunni. We never mention that in the Kurdish area, while everyone is Sunni almost everyone is Sufi. They have a Sufi-based religion. The Qadiris and the Naqshbandi are very strong there, and it's a spiritual side of Islam. And that's never mentioned. So that's one thing I wanted to say about the religion.
Yeah, can you go into the Sufism a little bit? How does that, what does that give us in terms of seeing Islam from another perspective?
Well, as I said, it's a spiritual side more than the a religion of many rules.
Religion,
And it's more of a personal thing. It's based in religions that come from India and other places. And for example, they're more likely to pray at home. They're more and not be too much of mosque types. And also to include other people in their religion. In the Barzan area, for example, Christians and Muslims and Yazidis, etc., live together in harmony and visit each other. In the short clip I showed at the Explorers Club, I showed during Nowruz, the Chaldean bishop visiting the Barzanis, and they were talking about their different religions. But the religions get along. While in other places, there's one group sets against the other because of religious beliefs or because of ethnicity. In the Kurdish area, you have a group that is multi-confessional and polyglot. You have like Yazidis, Alevis, Zoroastrians, Al-Haq, and the various types of Islamic and Christian groups, and they speak two types of Kurdish, plus Turkish, Arabic, and Aramaic. And I found it interesting when a movie came out recently and people were saying, oh, Aramaic's not spoken. Well, it's spoken in Kurdistan. The Christians speak it. And the Jewish community that they had a relatively strong Jewish community before Saddam made it very uncomfortable for them, and they spoke Aramaic. So hear Aramaic spoken there too.
You know what I wanted to ask you is, you know, okay, you're a filmmaker and you direct produced it. Now we see, I'm talking about we, you know, Hollywood land. Mm-hmm. We're seeing all these new, you know. A lot of the shows talk about this on TV. They have the series, whatever. And that's why some of us are feeling the way it is what we see on TV. How far away are some of these shows from what really happens there? You know, there's a lot of series on now about, you know, these countries, and what we see is not exactly what you're saying right now. So everybody's so afraid that even when they go there, they're showing that in a lot of the series. And that's what we see. How different is that from what you see?
It's totally different. I don't know how we have gotten so far away. I don't think we have a very good idea of what goes on in any of the Middle East, frankly. Yeah. We sort of see it as one big place. It's a very diverse place with all types of people. One thing I did when I went to Iran, and this is getting off the Kurds, but I started off, like I said, I went there dressed like in an impossibly stupid way, and then I got there and I took a few days off by myself where I wasn't staying with anyone, where I was staying at a hotel, and I started looking at the Lonely Planet, and they had a list of things you must not do in Iran. And I was just crazy enough to say, I wonder if I did these things. Like, a woman should not go out to eat by herself at night. And I went out to eat by myself, and I ended up being invited to every table in the restaurant and
really?
Talking to people and having a wonderful time.
Then I know I could be feel comfortable going there then, because then I could talk to everybody.
Yeah, and
let me interrupt here. So you said that your friend told you do not talk to politicians to find out what's going on in Kurdistan. Talk to the people. Are you finding that in Iran as well? If we listen to the politicians,
yeah.
My God, we're about to go to nuclear war. But you go out and you're invited to dinner and all the tables. I mean, are we seeing a disparity there? You know, this is very interesting.
Oh yeah, I found the people just divine. I was there. This almost never happens, and I doubt many Americans will ever have this possibility. But because, I'm not quite sure exactly why, but because I was working in that area, I somehow got a month-long visa to Iraq, where I could do to Iran, where I could do anything I wanted to. And that's usually you have to go in a pack, a group, you know.
Yeah.
And you're sort of told what to do, I guess. I don't know, because that wasn't my experience at all. I was totally by myself and did what I wanted to. And I had just a magnificent time and found people so nice and so pleasant. And a couple of men one time, much younger men than I, at a historical site, came up to me and started talking to me. And I finally said, I said, "Why are you talking to me? I'm the great Satan." They said, "We don't hate you. We hate your government. And if there's any government we hate worse than your government, it's our government. And if there's any government we hate worse than both of them, it's the guy next door. So if you take Saddam out, you're going to be our best friend." I mean, people would talk about that. And
wow.
I did not. I think that there's a disservice right now in journalism about the Middle East. I think there are very few journalists that really go and stay there and spend any time. I think a lot of people are going, being dropped in and coming back with impressions without any depth. And I think that's a disservice to all of us.
Well, can you
that could be the news shows now. That could be the 24-hour news shows.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that was just like the 24-hour news shows. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, look, Marianne, if you make a documentary, is your journalistic side, you know, sort of anxious, chomping at the bit to try to rectify some of this perception that we have?
Yeah, that's sort of a danger, isn't it? Yes, of course it is. And one of the things we're doing, we actually started off as just a foundation, a family foundation, and we were backing a film by Elizabeth Warnock Furnia, B.J. Furnia, who was a dear, dear friend of mine. She had an idea. She was the expert on the Shia women in Iraq. A book she wrote was in I think it's still in publication. In fact, it'd been in publication for like 60 years on Shia women. And she's also had done 7 films on women in the Middle East. And so she approached us about, since I knew the Kurds, and her director, Maysoon Pachachi, knew Baghdad well, we were going to do something on 3 women, on Iraq, and it'd be a short stories of 3 women in 3 different places. Unfortunately, BJ got sick after we started working on it, and then Maysoon had some problems and decided to move her operation over to Syria for a while. So we were left, and we were going to desert. But just about that time, my good friend Hiro Talabani, her husband was elected the first Kurdish president of Iraq. So she had been a Peshmerga and as she said, but she fought with her camera, not with her gun. And she had documented the poison gas attacks, et cetera. And then she went on to become a director in a television station and was starting to make a film. So she really encouraged us. She said, "Come on over. We really need women making films over here." So we finally just jumped in and did it. But what we're going to do with the foundation is now trying to do, we work with the University of Texas libraries, and we're archiving everything. We've got about 1,000 hours of film, for example.
Wow.
And what we're going to try to do now, and we're going to work with some members of the Explorers Club and with the UT Library and other people to try to get some of this material we have out more. We'll be looking for funding to really upgrade our website to where we can put out, you know, maybe once a week change everything and put in small clips and things to where we start to see people more. Because I think it's very dangerous that we are moving to this East-West where the East is all evil and the West is all good, or from their point of view, probably the opposite. It's very dangerous,
yeah.
and it's not real. It's I mean, obviously there are good and bad people every place.
You think the solution then is a little more education, a more broad-based exposure to the diversity?
Absolutely.
Do you think it's possible at this point?
Well, I think it. You know, I'm thinking about, look at ISIS and all these other people that they seem to get on the web and do this. I'm thinking.
Yeah, you know, we talked about that, right? You and I were talking about that. You know, and that's the thing that's very interesting is that, you know, that's what's happening is that, you know, they're on Facebook and they're on all these things and people are talking and everybody is doing that and people are actually believing everything that they hear, you know, and they're on there and their message may not be the same kind of message that really is real. We don't even know what's going on anymore because there's so much. Yeah, I was mentioning to Jack, one of the problems is you see when you're watching TV or any of these things, we're seeing different things now. You know, you're saying something different and we're not educated to the fact of knowing what's going on there. So we're thinking that everything, all these women are, you know, they don't have anything to say. They just live their life and they don't have their own feelings and emotions. But apparently they do, and we're not seeing that. And we're probably not seeing a lot of other things. And we're seeing whatever the news tells us.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's,
you know,
what we...
Something showed up the other day. It said something like 65 or 70% of Americans see Fox News as the most trusted news network.
Well,
right. I'm thinking, wow, none of what Marianne is telling me shows up on Fox News, that's for sure. You know?
Yeah.
So,
well,
wow,
this is what we'd like to change and also to get a group together. We're calling it we're working on Kurdistan right now because I think that as I said, it's in a very dangerous place, and it's a completely misunderstood society, even in the Middle East. So, I tell you, it's a lot like northern New Mexico, Jack, and you know northern New Mexico well. It looks like northern New Mexico, even. And I think that we want to try to do a really good website and be able to use things that are in our archive and get them out there. One thing I'm doing, too, is, for example, on the last shoot we did, which we just came back from, there was only one other American on the shoot that, other than me. My cameraman, Antonio Cisneros, and then we did have, Alex Whitcomb who lives now in Kurdistan because he's married to a Kurdish woman. So, but basically we work with Kurds. And another thing I'm doing more and more is working with young people because the way they communicate in a different way than I do. I have no patience for the web or for Facebook or any of that. I always foul it up, and so I mean I'm happy with a pencil and a piece of paper. So I'm trying to work more and more with younger people and to work more and more with people when I'm working in a place. Work with people, teach them how to use a camera, teach them how to do some things. And work with people in the area because
that
that's
where. Great.
Yeah, and I think that more people should do that. And like I said, you know, when this first started, I guess a couple of years ago, or just got bad and just was newsworthy, I heard people on TV, on established news places, and they were even had the geography wrong. You know, it wasn't that they had the people wrong. They had the places wrong. So,
well,
so they were being...
Right, they can say
they
what they want
shook.
And nobody else knows what they're talking about, right? Oh, my God.
Exactly. So it was very frightening. And I think that it's important that we start to see people. And I think coming from Texas, from South Texas, and coming from the South, I can remember as a child at least, and as and part of my... I mean, I can remember in my teenage years the segregation and the fear of blacks and Mexicans and whatnot. I always was rebellious against that. I always found that very offensive from the time I was 2 or 3 years old. I would follow my nanny around, and I sat in the back of the bus and sat in the balcony at the theater because I wouldn't leave her alone. So and I hated it all, and I was so happy when it all changed. And I think this is some of the same thing. These stereotypes we get of people, they're just not real. There's nobody in the world that is so completely without individuality as particularly TV tends to show them, I think.
Well, yeah, you know,
that everybody's a human being. Let me go back.
Yeah,
to
and I
thing.
Can I say one thing about, like, even
yeah,
go ahead, Jeff.
Go
you go ahead. No, go ahead. No, go ahead. I'll talk in a minute.
Okay. One of the issues that I have run up against is the Turkish government's attitude towards Kurdistan. Is that problematic and sort of ambivalent? Do you see it that way? Or
this is very difficult to me, because I've lived in Turkey and I love Turkey and I have a lot of friends there. But when I was investigating it, even when I was there, and I started seeing a little bit about the problems with the Kurds and other groups and whatnot, and some with the Christians, frankly. I was talking to someone high up in the government, and I kept saying, well, the way we deal with minorities, and he said, we have no minorities. We have no minorities. We are all Turks. Well, you know, that's not going to endear the Kurds to them, and it doesn't endear them to the Kurds. I find that's. Do you know that the Ottoman Empire was multi-confessional, multi-ethnic, and the people all got along. It wasn't until after World War I when the British and the sort of reinvented the Middle East that all of a sudden people started grouping in nationalists and religious groups and being so separated from one another. This is a fairly new thing in the Middle East. I'm talking about in a very large area. I mean, a large area of time here, but. I think that I would like to see Turkey get over that, and not just Turkey. I'm not just going to say that about Turkey, but when I'm sitting around and I'm listening to people fight over, you know, well, we can't get along with Iran because that will make Israel mad, and we can't get along with the Kurds because that will make Turkey mad. Well, you know, their being mad is their problem, not ours.
Yeah.
And what really is so bad today, and Tom Friedman mentioned that in one of his things, that the way ISIS got where it is when the society starts to fall apart. He said, like, if you had a garden and your plants started to die, then invasive plants can come in. And I think that's exactly what's happening in a way.
Wow.
When people sit there and fight these little bitty petty fights and just can't get over them, and we take sides in them, which I have no idea why we do. You know, you can't like Iran because that will make somebody mad, and if you're nice to Syria, are you... I got in a lot of trouble because I just could not understand why we wanted to take out Bashar Assad. I don't know that he's, you know, the prince of virtue or something, but the question is, who were the people that were fighting? We didn't really have a good idea. I just think these little fights, like I said, I've become very disinterested in what the Turks are the Israelis or anybody thinks, because
nobody gets along with each other. You know, like yesterday, when you and I were talking, I was talking about yesterday's show you know, I'm going to bring this up again, because the movie was about after World War II, kind of like right in that vicinity, and it was like there was so much prejudice against some, you know, different things that were happening in the World War, and I think that people in World War One, and people come back that way, and they're teaching their children. What happens is, if the families don't teach their children to, you know, be more tolerant, this is what's happening, is that kids are coming up with their own, not their own, they get it from home. And so they become, they're bullying and being prejudiced at a very young age, and it never stops. So they become adults and they're prejudiced, because that's how they learn. And so we're having a world that everybody's not liking anybody else anymore.
Let me ask you another question that sort of swinging around. Has this experience changed your perception of America? And if so, to what degree? What are you now seeing here?
You know, yes and no. That's a very complicated question.
what a surprise.
I don't have any sympathy for people who say, well, if we hadn't gone over there, I don't believe that. I think that certainly the first Gulf War had to be done. The second one, I never understood. I just never even understood it. You know, it's interesting, because my daughter, Katie Bruni, who was quite a scholar and then quite a dancer, a ballet dancer for a while, and now is sort of enjoying the good life. I ask her, why is this happening? She said, well, don't you understand? I said, why are people in the United States, for example, joining ISIS? And why are people in the West? Why is this happening? And she said, because young people like to have a reason. They like to have a mission. And all the mission now is go to school, which you can't afford anymore, and go to Wall Street and make money, and it's all about money, and it's all about buying things, and they're left with no mission in life. And all of a sudden, since education's getting more expensive and a lot of different social programs we have for more do not exist anymore, they're not even able to enter that. So all of a sudden, here's someone that gives them a mission and and some way to have a job or to do something. And actually, my good friend here in New York, Joanne Potlitzer, and I had dinner last night, and she reminded me of the time she and I and Katie had gotten together. And she agreed totally with Katie, and she said, "No, there's a vacuum here in which the young people don't have an ideal, a goal, a mission to follow."
They're in a group.
Yeah.
They like to be in a group where someone tells them what to do, because they don't have anybody telling them what to do. Maybe at home, that's how neo-Nazis became so big, because I think a lot of the people that went into the groups of neo-Nazis, the young ones, they didn't have a family, so they went, they thought that was a family. They don't even, people start hating, and they don't know why they hate. They're just in the group.
Do you remember
that? They like to
that,
feel there's a family.
You all make me think of South Pacific in that song, "You've Got to Be Carefully Taught."
And they're not taught. Yes. Yeah. I think that happens a lot. And I think that,
so,
you know,
in a way, then your perception of America has become, you know, much more objective in a very real way by this experience over there, because what you're saying is we have no understanding of the suffering that's going on. We cannot imagine 180,000 or whatever the number was, people being slaughtered because they're Kurds. You know, we can't imagine 4,500 villages being destroyed by poison gas or whatever. So your perception that you're bringing here really broadens my own view you know, of one, what's going on in the world, and two, what's going on here. And for the life of me, I cannot understand this really strong rightward shift that's taking place in America. Can you see why it's happening with respect to where you have been?
I don't understand it at all. When I first graduated from college, the first thing I did was vote Republican, and I was very, very conservative. And over the years, I'm afraid I've backslid into liberalism in a big way. It just makes more sense. And I don't even think it's that so much. I think when we think of, like, after the Depression, when Roosevelt came in and had work programs and these programs of building post offices and building highways and building, and now look at what's happening. This isn't something I learned in Kurdistan, but bridges are falling down and things aren't being taken care of, and consequently people don't have jobs to take care of them or to build. So I don't quite understand it.
Because it's turning into a big mess, one big mess, and everybody's starting to hate each other, and nobody, you know, everybody has their cause, but nobody's working together. So if nobody works together, we can't get anything done, and that's what's happening. That's why we see this. There's nothing happening.
I try not to. I mean, I know that I feel bad because I've said some things about Turks and about Americans and about whatnot. I really don't think that way. In a sense, I think. I try not to be judgmental, particularly in big swatches of things. I think that's too easy. I think that there's good and bad in every society and in every place, but there is what I think is upsetting me is the lack of understanding of what's going on the other side of the world, because we're involved in it now, and we need to understand it more. And we don't need to be so judgmental, because we could turn right around and people could... I think that's another thing, too. When I first started going to the Middle East, that whole part of the world tended to be pro-American, and it isn't anymore. It has become very anti-American.
Let me look at your comments to the Explorers Club. You had a couple sentences that just absolutely fascinated me, and I want you to elaborate on them if you can. And you say, "The Kurds and I now face our third act, the challenge presented by destructive forces that threaten the entire country of Iraq, indeed perhaps the entire world." What are you reading there? What are you seeing there that we need to know?
Well, is it, to me as a filmmaker, I was really speaking of that, and I'd like to address that. I started this second film several years ago, and then watching what was going on, I couldn't quite make sense out of it and sort of put it aside. And now... I've got to go in and finish it, and I, particularly in getting together, it was very strange, in getting together this presentation I made at the Explorers Club, I did a very quick, say, 10-minute history of the last 20 years in Kurdistan by using, as Ibrahim Ahmed had suggested, by using people and their stories rather than statistics or other means, now our third act, so to speak, is because what is the end of that? That will be go by very quickly in my film, and probably the third act will get the largest part. But it's that everything's changed now. There's a huge enemy there. We can't keep talking about, well, do we like Israel, or do we like the Turks, or do we like the Iranians, or do we like the Syrians? Or we just don't have that luxury anymore.
Okay.
That's kind of what I meant. And it's a challenge, too, for the Kurds. What are they going to do now? They were totally destroyed. And then the miraculous rebuilding they did just out of having faith and being stubborn and being and deciding they were going to rebuild. They rebuilt, and now all of a sudden you the empty buildings is like a sign there that building things that didn't get finished, and now the emptiness, the people who fled, the people who've gone someplace else, the various international businesses that have left because of the danger there, and that is really the thing now. What are we going to do about? And I hate to just say ISIS because I don't think it's just ISIS or one group. What are we going to do about the danger that has built up in this part of the world? How are we going to face it? And how are the Kurds going to face it as members of that community? How am I going to face it as a filmmaker and journalist writing about it?
Well,
does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You mentioned this loan that comes due. Well, as I understand it, but please correct me if I'm misinformed here, but don't the Kurds have access to a certain amount of oil wealth? And if
the problem
so,
is,
okay.
Yeah. Oh, two things. Of course, the oil market. I, being a Texan, hear more about it probably than you do. But the oil market is way down, and people over in this country are crying, as the money doesn't come in. But secondly, they have not been paid their part of the money from Baghdad. That's what's happening. Baghdad's not getting along with them, and so they're holding back money, and that part of that money was to pay public servants, to pay for upkeep, to pay for all sorts of things in Kurdistan, and that money is being held in Baghdad. And for some reason, and then I want to mention something else too that surprised me. And there was an American colonel who's retired over there who's now working in security and some other matters. And I was asking him, how is it that apparently Baghdad had all this money and they had all these weapons and they couldn't hold back ISIS, and yet the Kurds who had nothing could? And he said, well, it's really simple. He said there were plenty of people there. There were plenty of soldiers there, and there was abundant equipment. But the minute the soldiers saw ISIS coming, they ran. And just left the equipment. They had no feeling for what they were doing. They had no particular patriotism for anything, and they didn't see the point in risking their lives. They just took off. And, of course, ISIS got all of that and came up there. He said, on the other hand, when they came up and almost got into Erbil, when the Kurds found out, people were jumping into their wrecked and falling apart trucks and grabbing their Soviet weapons left over from the, from 1900 and running to the front to fight.
Wow.
Because they had the feeling of their land and their place, and that was the difference. He said, you can't fight a war without any any fighters, And I don't understand why. I really don't understand. What frightens me is not if the Kurds are right or Baghdad's right or who's right or wrong, but if something isn't done to stop this movement, and I don't think it's just ISIS, it's like just some big evil thing hanging there. And if we don't all get together, and the Iranians and the Syrians and the Turks and everybody get together and fight this, it's going to be, I think, I think it's going to get worse. And as
well,
I told somebody,
I'd
rather fight.
Go ahead.
I'd rather fight them in Kurdistan than in South Texas.
Well, that's a pretty.
So what? All right, so as a filmmaker, what would you say to? I mean, you're a strong woman because there's a lot of women or there's a lot of men that won't be doing what you're doing. But what can women as filmmakers do to try to get some of these social issues brought out so we see the right side of it, not just what we're hearing on the news?
Well, it's going to be hard because I don't... One thing that surprised me, too, I saw almost no journalist over there of any sort. I know that there are, and I know some names of some people that are there, so I'm not saying there are none, but there
right.
aren't nearly enough. And I think that people have to go. I think we have to... I think we have to be curious. I think we have to be brave. I think we have to try to understand other people rather than getting in huge fights or putting up huge amounts of money or taking sides with one group against another. I think it takes just a lot of understanding. And I think one thing that's happening today is with the internet and this, that, and the other, everybody wants instant gratification, instant information.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not like when we all were in school and you had to prove, you had to investigate and prove and back up and give examples.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's no backup.
They don't
sometimes.
Do that anymore.
They just say, no. Well, yeah, because, you know, when you're tweeting, it just, like when they tweet, it just comes out if you feel like saying it. And then all of a sudden you go, oh, my God, I shouldn't have said that. And then you got everybody on you. And so it's in people in the news media and in TV everywhere, they're talking about tweets and Facebook and everything like it's all real. And that's what we said before. But that is the truth. I don't know if that'll stop because that's what's happened. I don't know how you could stop that because people actually do believe everything they hear or get mad at someone and they just all of a sudden you say something that isn't exactly right, people go insane and the person is like, you know, they've lost their job, they're done. They're completely done.
Well, you know,
there's no turning
back
for them.
Of course, misinformation. You know, if people don't know anything, if they're not educated, if they don't understand at all, you know, when you say that your newscasters have a wrong map up there when they're talking about that part of the world. I mean, that's pretty monumental ignorance, you know, and that seems to be, no nation seems to have a corner on that. You know, that really strikes me as something, the believability of things. Let me ask you this. It has been showing up as a YouTube video that ISIS members have been destroying, you know, all of the monuments in the Mosul Museum, and they have been destroying the bearded bulls or the men bulls, you know, from the old days because they said it's, you know, a graven image and that sort of thing. Is that actually happening, or is that a misinformation that we're getting somehow into our systems here?
I think it's actually happening, and that's one of the things that's so frightening. Is, as I said, when I was over there for 3 weeks, it was an early spring, absolutely beautiful. It was quiet. It was peaceful. It was sort of, as I said, the quiet before the storm. And I was at a 6th century monastery, and it was absolutely so beautiful. And when you entered this facade of the monastery, you all of a sudden were in a series of caves. But with pieces of the early religion there, and in the background you could hear the it was so close to the front you could hear artillery and you could hear guns and you could see smoke coming up and. That's another thing. It's everything. That's when I say geographically they've got it all wrong. Also, some of the camps, for refugees are right at the Mosul Dam almost and right at the front. It's very, very frightening. And there's, as I said, there are not many people there that could be showing it. I was glad, though, that we were filming, and I actually found a 10-millimeter lens in Kurdistan and rented it and went up on top of a mountain and we could take, you know, we could film from there and you could see that these refugee camps of Yazidis, who ISIS more than anybody wants to kill because they consider them just the worst, and they're, as I said, they're very close. They must be 15 miles maybe from the Mosul Dam and the front. And that's all very frightening. And yes, they are destroying things. That's part of the thing, is to kill the people and destroy the religions. And in Kurdistan, as I said, while other people are really fighting about what religion you are, because of the Sufi influence there and the Islam there, and the strong feeling of acceptance of other people and other religions, it's the last place where these people are. It's the last place they can be. And if there isn't help from the international community, number one, they're going to be killed, and number two, they'll just simply starve to death at some point. And I was glad, like I said, to hear Fareed Zakaria mention that that the same thing. Talk about the same thing, but talk about it in Jordan. He said Jordan's taking in all these refugees, and it's not sustainable. And so what happens?
See, but when
the international community continues not to come in and not to help, do we just let all these people die or get killed? Because they can't continue to be kept where they are now. I don't think there's any way. And I think that's what Fareed Zakaria was saying.
See, but when you're filming, I mean, you just can film whatever you want. Nobody tells you don't film this. Because I think that people might think that you can't just go everywhere. So when you're filming, does anybody stop you at all or ever say, what are
no.
you doing?
No, no. Oh, I haven't had any trouble at all. They seem to be quite happy.
See, that's really interesting. That would not be what... Jack, would you think that?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm listening.
Would you think that somebody... Would you think, though? No, but would you think, though?
I have a million ideas and a million
questions. I know, but would you really think that you could just go in? Because I think that people would be fearful and, you know, that they're, you know,
well,
especially
see,
when you're filming.
This is one of those misperceptions that we have, you
yeah,
see.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we're
yeah.
told, oh, God, you don't want to go over there because blah, blah, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And you're Mariana saying, no, I just went where I wanted and filmed what I wanted.
I know.
Thinking,
I know. It's
so
different.
Victory, you know, to the peril that we are given to perceive,
yeah.
you know, that
wow.
I just am stunned here by everything you're saying, actually. And I have
know.
One question for you. I read somewhere, and I forget who said it, someone said, Western women will save the world.
Well,
okay.
You know what? I would add that Eastern women might do that, too.
Okay. There you go. Let's say that together. Together. Together.
Yeah, together we might do it. Did you see, did you get a chance to look at the film clip? I think I sent
Not
it to
yet.
You.
I have been tied up all
okay.
afternoon, but I will.
But
yes.
but you'll see some strong women there in that. And,
okay.
and one of them says, it's women that have to change this place.
Well, that's what we, I don't like to get too political on my show, but I agree with that for America also. So I'll just say that, I think that, you know, getting back to the beginning of this whole show, women are a lot stronger than people think, and we can handle a lot of things, you know, and Jack's the one that knows it. That's right. Jack knows
it. My mother has a little plaque in her bedroom or kitchen or something like that. It says, a woman is like a tea bag. You never know how strong she is till you put her in hot water.
That's right. There you go. There you go.
Yeah, you know.
I think that's true. I think that people really don't realize how tough we are. We are strong. We are resilient to a lot of things, and we can do a lot of things. And Marianne, you are doing them. And this, you know, I feel like, oh my God, this is so exciting what you do. And I'm thinking, maybe I should stop going to the malls and maybe do something else that's so exciting like this. Actually, but I think it's really wonderful. And you know, I know we're over an hour, and I know you're in New York, so you're tired probably, Marianne, but will you come back again? Because it's so interesting to hear all of this, because we don't hear this. And Jack, I know Jack is shocked of all of this, right? So, I mean, it's so interesting to hear this. I mean, and...
Well, I would love to. I'm really going to... I'm a real coward. I like to sit home and write and to do my little things and to direct and to be behind the scenes. And I don't usually like to get out. But I suddenly realize that it's important that we take every opportunity to talk and to engage and to to go forward.
Right, because you never know who hears it.
I have one last question for you.
What?
Have you ever felt endangered by your the results of your film and your documentary and your work? Have you ever felt threatened by, you know, the powers that be, or have you as an artist felt pretty much that you could do what you wanted to do without having to worry about any fatwa or anything like that?
Well, at this point in my life, you know, I've been doing what I want for so many years that it's kind of hard to change. I do do this, though. I don't, for example, when I was in Iraq, I didn't do any publicity or any, you know, daily updates or anything like that on the web or something silly like that, because I'm careful.
Yeah,
I'm careful,
yeah.
But I'm not really frightened, but I am careful, and I'm a private person. You know, I insist on my privacy. I don't. I will do things for other people, and I will do things for the causes I care about. But basically, my parents were like that too. So I have a sort of a desire to stay private. And yet engage when
right. No, you can do that. No, you can do that, because I do that every day, because I talk about, I have my shows and I have my books and I promote and I talk about my books, but I don't, my personal life is mine, you know, and I do believe that people should be doing that much more than they do that, because people are out there. I see this all the time, saying things they probably should never say. And they're out there, and I don't know why they even do these things. But I feel like you have to have some kind of privacy, even though we're out there because we do things like this. It doesn't mean they have to know everything about your personal life. It's just what you do.
I won't even on my iPhone or on my stuff, if it says, you know, can we use your
location?
What is it, your location? I put down
location.
No.
Yeah.
No,
me too.
I don't want anyone
to
be able to pick up my location. So I like I said, I'm out there, and I certainly feel like I need to be, but I like my privacy, and I like to know that at a certain point I can sort of disappear. That's one thing I like. Now, you know, you were talking about women writers and whatnot in the Middle East. I'm trying to think of her name. She's become a novelist now, and she used to write for the Wall Street Journal. Anyway, we were talking about that women journalists have an edge over men in the Middle East. And why would that be? Number one,
they can talk to women, right?
They can talk to women. Men can't talk to women. The whole thing about harem and privacy is. The women can go wherever they want to. It's the men who can't go into the women's quarters. And then first of all, if you're living with women, if you're living in a place with women, you're getting all the women's gossip, and they know it. You know, they know way better than the journalists do what's going on. So also, if you get into trouble, and at least once I've done this, you can just stay in a house. As a woman, you can walk in anybody's house almost and stay there and be protected. And men really aren't going to come in there and come after you. Also, I had one friend who was the mother-in-law of a friend of mine, and she was a spy. She'd been a spy during all the things, and women are usually the spies because people don't want to. To search them or do this, that, or the other, so they can go right through lines and things. So, actually, women have a very good position in the Middle East. And also, as somebody else said, there's another word they use. And at other times, in some cases, you become an honorary man, which means you can also sit with the men. And so you've got two groups to deal with, whereas a male journalist can only usually be with the men.
Well, why don't American systems then, you know, news systems, you know, send more women over there? Do they perceive it as too dangerous? to...
I don't know what they do or not. I mean, well, think about it. There's been... I think one of the best person being over there was Christine Amanpour, and I'm trying to think of this woman who went on to become a really great novelist who was in Iran for a while. Anyway, there are a lot of women journalists in the Middle East, or there used to be. I just don't see many journalists. I haven't seen many journalists in Kurdistan at all recently.
How are we getting any information then? I mean, if the journalists aren't on the ground, taking pictures and talking to people, our news systems are just full of garbage then that have no foundation in observation. Are they just third, fourth voice, fourth eye, fourth hand kind of stuff? Is that what we're
hearing?
I don't
know. I really can't comment on that. I really don't know what's going on. But I do sense that. I think that right now that people are really frightened of maybe an air attack or this or that or the other.
Yeah.
And I know, for example, that ExxonMobil and that had a big office in Erbil, that their people are working from home now. They're still working, but they're working from home. They're not coming into the office. And some people have sent their employees out. So... I think it's also probably big companies not wanting the liability of having people in what could become a war zone very quickly.
Right.
Like I said, I feel like I know so many Kurds and I'm friends with so many people that I can duck into somebody's house and I'm going to have people looking after me. And I've developed a sort of a security system of my own while I'm there. But I can understand why big corporations and things are pulling their people out.
Right. Yeah.
Because
are you planning on returning anytime soon?
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm flying. I'll tell you tomorrow night. I'm flying to New Mexico, and I'm going to be there for Easter. We're going to be filming in Taos. Mm-hmm. And then right after that, I'm going to go home for about a week, and then I'm going back to Iraq for a month.
Back to Iraq. Wow.
And then I think
this
I'm going
incredible.
To. We're going to, and then we're going to stop and edit and spend a lot of time just locked away editing.
In your notes to the Explorers Club, your last line is "Meet the Kurds." Will that be the title of your documentary?
No, actually. I was kind of disappointed. Because I've been over and looking at the new things and whatnot. But of course, I was going to be speaking, and there wasn't time to cut anything from what we had. So I went back and cut something. My supervising producer and I did this over the phone from scraps, but it was very effective as it turned out. What we did is we showed how we worked with Kurds. I said, you may not meet these people. You may not see these people in our films, but they're the people behind the scenes that we were talking to and working with, and that's what I show. I show three different groups. I show the Barzanis, and then I show a friend of mine, Dr. Atiya, and what was happening in the chemical attacks over in Balisan. And then she's a doctor and her cousin's a mayor, and so you get to see how what women are really like there. And then at the end we show Hero Talabani, who has been a good friend of mine, and how she went from being a Peshmerga to being a photographer to being a filmmaker, and the things that she's done.
This is very enlightening. This is unbelievably enlightening, and I'm thinking, because what we see, I'm going to ask you. This is just like a regular question. Do you watch any of the shows like Homeland or any of those shows?
I don't
have no time,
television.
Probably. See, so you don't watch. I knew you were going to say that. That's why I knew after I asked that question. I knew there's no way you're watching television. But I thought, well, maybe you might watch some TV. So you don't watch TV at all?
Not very much. I watch the Sunday morning. I like the Sunday morning news programs. Some of those I like.
Oh, I bet you do, because I do too. I love how they sit there and talk about nothing. Going there talking, and each one of them said they have like the same people talking about the same thing every week on a different station. It's unreal. I mean, that's how I view it when I look at it. How do you feel when
I guess I like them compared to the other news I see. South Park. I watch South Park.
Okay.
So that's
I have a technical question for you.
What?
Are you shooting on film or are you shooting all digital?
We're shooting digital now.
Digital.
I mean, for documentary, there's a lot of reasons. First of all, it's a lot cheaper. It's a lot easier. And you're not changing. You couldn't really do a documentary and have to be changing your film all the time and whatnot.
Right.
Yeah. It's
it just makes more sense. And we keep cameras over. And I have three cameras over in Kurdistan even when I'm not there. So that if anything happens or anything that they think is important or anything that they want to document, people can do that. And one person is Mohammed Sadiq Barzani is doing wildlife for us.
Wow.
We've got a variety of things. And that's what I think, really, when you show up people, you can't just show their leaders. You really have to get in and show what they eat and what they're cooking and what they grow and... You know, you have to get into the details of their life. I mean, that's even in fiction as well, you know, Jack. You've got to get the details right so that to flesh out what people are like and what's happening.
Exactly.
Yes, you have to do that. And, you have to do that. I mean, you know, people, because certainly now people, you know, are very educated and they know a lot of different things that they really, you know, and if you say something that's not true, and they're not happy with that. So, you know, when we're writing, we always have to do things that are, even if it's fiction, you don't want to be off the wall and say something that doesn't apply to anything, because people will catch you on anything.
I've come up with a new concept in my writing about these things, especially dealing with technical or scientific notions. It says it can be true without being factual. You know, in other words, the emotional part of it can be there, can be exact, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, scientifically exact. You know, and I've been working off of that for quite a while now, trying to figure out how to write this novel that I'm in. And that seems to get me over the hump, you know, and it's not exactly lying, but it's not exactly, you know, focusing on the exact detail of this is what happens.
Right, what's happening.
And I think that as a filmmaker, it's your obligation, in a way, to get to that truth. And at the same time, the images are so factual that you can't deny them. You know, so do you have any footage of the refugee camps?
Oh, yes. Yes, we've got a lot of footage of the refugee camps. We spent quite a bit of time there.
Yeah.
And then we got on top of the mountain and photographed them from above so you could see exactly where they were and how they fit together.
Boy, that's really powerful stuff that you just talked
about. This is really... All right, so, you know, Marianne, you are... Anytime, just call... You have my number and you can... Jack and you both can come on and we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about, because I do find this very interesting and I think this is something that people really need to hear. So I'm willing to, you know, I love this. Because it's so much you learn. And you know what? No matter whoever you are, everybody needs to learn something. You don't know everything. So sometimes it's always good to hear about things you're not used to hearing about. So
well,
I think this is a good
thing. Educational for me.
Really? I know. It's
good. Oh, yeah.
Jack,
I always say
you know everything. Jack, I always tell everybody, Jack knows everything.
Well,
so I don't know what to do.
I know a little bit, but not nearly enough. I've got to start reading something about the Middle East, you know, I mean, and I can't get it off of TV. So anyway, you know, that's where I am right now.
All right.
Okay,
are we about to wrap it up here? Well, we should probably, because I know it's 10:30 in New York, and that's where Marianne is. Right, she's in New York, and, you know, and it's... She's east. And you yep. did you have dinner yet? You're just starting the night.
Yeah.
I'm
just
to
it, yeah. So anyway,
I'm in the middle.
Marianne,
I'm in
Chicago.
All right, thank you
delightful.
So much. Yes,
yeah,
it was wonderful.
And I've had just a really great
time. And Jack,
time.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm going to look at those videos now and, you know, see what all you've been doing.
Yeah,
okay.
Send them to you. Email them to me.
Say again, please.
It's not the film, she said.
It's not
the film.
It's the backstory. It's how we, it's a little bit about how we and the Kurds work together to get the material to make the film.
Okay.
You'll see that when you see it, but I just want to make sure that you don't think it's a film.
That's good. Okay. This has been
all right,
so
good night, and thank you. And
thanks
thank
so
you
much.
So much.
We will be in touch,
all right, thank you again.
Everybody. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank
and
you
I know,
very much, Marianne.
Yes. And yes, thank
Marcia,
you so much.
Thank you very much, too.
Thank you,
we'll
Jack.
You
it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Thank both of you. It was just
right.
wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you, and Jordan.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye. I'm good.
Bye.
Bye-bye.